From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. With over 50 million Americans having cast their ballots in early voting states, 2020 is on track to have the highest turnout for a presidential race in years. But one demographic whose turnout has remained small in the past are the original inhabitants of this land. Native American voters have historically had low rates of turnout for reasons that are deeply linked to the history of systematic racism. Will this year be any different? My guest is Jane Reith Schrodel. She is the Thornton F. Bradshaw Professor of Public Policy at Claremont Graduate University. Her earlier book was Evangelicals and Democracy in America, Religion and Politics. She now joins me to discuss her latest book, Voting in Indian Country, The View from the Trenches. Welcome to the program, Jane.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I think many people, and I count myself among them, have not really been aware of the fact that, like other demographics, Native Americans also had to have their ability to vote, their right to vote, be enshrined in a law. You know, like women had to wait up until just about 100 years ago, African Americans even later than that. Native Americans had their right to vote in 1924, less than 100 years ago. So let's start there. Tell me about the Indian Citizenship Act and what led to it. What did it mean?
Well, the Indian Citizenship Act actually did not give the native people in this country the right to vote. Ah. It said nothing about voting, but it did say that American Indians, Alaska Natives who were born within the borders of the United States had U.S. citizenship. But at that time, many states still statutorily had laws that precluded Native Americans from voting. And keep in mind that states have the right, according to the Constitution, to determine the time, places, and procedures for elections and voting. This is part of the Constitution. I paraphrased it. But what that meant is the right to be a U.S. citizen. The citizenship did not necessarily come with the right to vote. So that then went to the states, and states with large Native populations did many, many things to disenfranchise this group of new citizens.
So it basically then was a patchwork approach to voting rights. Was there a uniform desire among this very heterogeneous demographic? Because, of course, there are so many different tribes, geographically and culturally different from one another. Was there any sort of consensus around the desire to vote in U.S. elections?
Well, that is a great question, and I'm so glad you recognize the extreme diversity across these populations. I mean, it is true that at the time that U.S. citizenship came into play, that many people who were Native said, we don't want this, we are not interested in this, we want our own separate sovereignty. But the truth of the matter is that it's become extremely important for Native Americans to vote. Many of the rights that people have and the governmental services require that the population have a voice. And it was really after the Second World War that the National Congress for American Indian, NACAI, National Congress of American Indians, was established and really made it a strong national push for voting rights for Native Americans. I mean, there were a number of court cases in the 1940s where U.S. military veterans, people like Frank Harrison, came in different states and challenged laws that statutorily disenfranchised all of them. It wasn't just the laws like in the South that had literacy tests, but there were laws that said no American Indians can vote, including one that said that you would have to terminate your Native identity to be able to vote. And if so, you had to go before a judge, and the judge would decide if you were sufficiently white in that sense to to be allowed to vote. So it's a very, very troubled history. And even as we turn to the 1965 Voting Rights Act, at the time the VRA was passed, and it was really interesting, I went through personally and read all of the over thousand pages of debates in Congress and documents that were supporting. And Native Americans were only mentioned very briefly in two very brief spots in that act. Wow. And in fact, many people thought they were not even covered by the VRA.
So when did that change? When did we have a situation where there was not only a uniform or universal right to vote across all states and a perhaps near universal desire among this demographic to vote in U.S. elections?
Well, that's a two-part question. I mean, the right to vote, as I said, the VRA, it was not even clear that it applied. And it wasn't really enforced until after about 10 years later, when there were several really egregious cases of vote denial. For example, there was a man named Tom Shirley who ran, I believe it was in 1972, for a county seat in Arizona. He was on the Navajo Nation, on the reservation. He ran for a county seat. He got three times the vote of his white opponent, but the county refused to seat him. So in 1975, the U.S. Civil Rights Commission issued a report that showed that what the VRA had accomplished, mostly focused on African-American populations in the South, but they also brought in examples of really egregious denial of the right to vote from Indian country, including the one I just mentioned. And so 1975, in that sense, was a turning point. This was also the period in U.S. history where there was a great deal of Native American activism. We're thinking about the Wounded Knee occupation and a variety of other social protests. It was called the Red Power Era. So the 70s into the early 80s was a kind of turning point. But there's still, even today, there is much higher levels of voting on tribal elections as opposed to non-tribal elections, state and federal government elections. And part of this is rooted in a deep distrust. And that comes from the history of racial animus. So in 2016, I was part of a team that did surveys in New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, and South Dakota. I was part of the group that went to Nevada and South Dakota. We did surveys of more than 1,500 Native Americans. And they evinced in these surveys extraordinarily low levels of trust in the non-tribal governments, but the lowest level of trust, I mean, single digits level, was in the level of trust for state governments, which are the ones that they encounter on a daily basis, right? State and county governments.
Right. So we've only had congressional representation of Native candidates and Native lawmakers in recent years. It's kind of shocking that that's the case. What are some of the barriers to voting that we see in the modern era? And I'd love to move into a discussion of some of those barriers this year. You mentioned 2016. And of course, we know especially that the Republican Party has now adopted as a campaign strategy, seemingly, that voter suppression is a path to political power. So that impacts people who traditionally vote Democratic, which includes people of color in general, Black voters, Latino voters, youth voters. I imagine that also impacts Native voters.
Absolutely. I mean, but what I would say is all of the things that are employed to depress, suppress, dilute, whatever terms one wishes to use, the populations that you mentioned. All of those are applied to the indigenous population, but they often have what I call a twist, something that makes it even harder. So let me give you an example, okay? Researchers have found that if you close polling places and force people to move, travel, say, a quarter of a mile further to be able to vote, there's a statistically significant decline in participation. And we know that in the past 4 years, there's been well over 1,000 polling places closed, mostly in minority communities. But what this means is different when we're talking about individuals who live in Native on reservations in particular, or if we're talking about Alaska Natives in Native villages, because the distances are dramatically further.
So the sort of same challenges that rural voters face in general.
But exponentially
but worse, right.
Further. So for example, if you look, I spent some time at the Duck Valley Reservation, which is on the border of Idaho, Nevada and Idaho. And there is no election day polling place there. There's not a drop box. So if people want to cast an in-person ballot, they have to travel roughly 100 miles or 200 miles round trip to Elko. Or if you go to the Navajo Reservation, which I've spent a chunk of time on also, the Navajo Reservation is literally larger than the state of West Virginia. Very limited number of polling places, but there's a big push in Arizona, for example, to vote by mail. This election, they're expecting probably 90% to use vote by mail. But most reservations do not have residential mail delivery. So you have to go to a post office. You have no choice if you want to vote. But remember, the Navajo Nation is larger than the state of West Virginia.
Wow.
There are only 40 places in the entire reservation where you can obtain mail or post mail. West Virginia has 725. But it's even worse because we are talking about a poor population, a large number who do not have access to vehicles. So they do not travel regularly to get mail. If you do not cannot afford a post office box, and there's a shortage of post office boxes, you have to do general delivery. If you do not get your mail within 1 month, that mail is either returned or discarded. So, as I said, there's a twist. It's harder because of the distances and the lack of institutional support that you will find from the federal government, state government, and county governments.
What about the issue of voter ID laws? We've heard that in states with large Native populations where Republicans have changed voter ID laws, they have deliberately left out Native or tribal voters' ID cards.
Well, it's a huge issue. This was one of the big issues that was in North Dakota in 2018, when 3 weeks before the election, the U.S. Supreme Court allowed the state of North Dakota to put in place a voter ID law that required residential street addresses on government-issued identification, knowing full well that people on reservations, they don't have street addresses. They have post office boxes. The roads often do not have names. If they do have names, they don't have the numbers associated with it. So it was extremely hard. It was very malicious. There was a huge effort that I was fortunate to be part of to use GIS and things to create these addresses. But I mean, just part of this incredible attack on the right to vote. One of the examples I did these wonderful interviews with people who are lawyers, activists, plaintiffs in lawsuits. And this woman who's a lawyer at the Arizona State University Indian Law Clinic, was telling me about the challenges that occurred with one woman, an elderly Navajo woman who had voted all of her life. And prior to their having the ID law, she would go in and she would use her thumbprint as a documenting who she was. And the people knew her. And when Arizona put in the strict voter identification laws, this woman decided she knew she had to get a government, Arizona state government identification document. She had tribal IDs, but she had to get a state one. So she got a ride to the closest DMV office to get identification document. They told her they did not issue them there. Well, she'd heard they issued them for white people, but you know, she went and she got more materials and she reached out to the lawyer I mentioned, Patty Ferguson Bonet, who then went with her to the DMV. And they refused to provide her with a document. They said they didn't issue them there. So then Ferguson Bonet took the elderly woman and they drove to Flagstaff, which is where the main DMV offices were. And they went in there. And the people at the DMV there refused to give the woman an identification document. They said that her tribal documents would not count to prove who she was. And in particular, she had been born at home, so she didn't have a birth certificate. So they tried to say she was not a US citizen. Fortunately, Ferguson Bonet was able to pressure them sufficiently, the clout of being a law school professor and a lawyer, and was able to get this woman an identification document so that she could vote. But that took 8 hours driving and a lawyer. How many people be able to go to that extent in order to get an identification document?
Quite an incredible story. So that is one example, and we may never hear of the countless examples of people who simply gave up, and rightfully so, because it's not like you get paid to vote. It's a right, but it's not something that one does have to go out of one's way. And when there are barriers thrown up over and over again, it can appear pointless, and that's such a tragedy. What about this year's situation, particularly with the coronavirus pandemic, which we know has hit some areas, some reservations in particular, some tribal governments and communities very, very hard? Is that yet another barrier?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, COVID has been horrible in this country, and particularly for people of color. And Native Americans have among the highest rates of COVID. And the meaning of this pandemic, though, is even greater, because one needs to understand that this was a population that was devastated by the arrival of Europeans who brought with them diseases such as smallpox. So when we're talking about a pandemic, it has both a historical and a cultural resonance that is much more devastating as it is for all of us, but much more devastating in many ways for that community and population. So yeah, COVID has made voting by mail a bigger issue. It has, many states are advocating voting by mail. If you look, for example, let me talk for a moment about South Dakota. South Dakota is a state that is called the Mississippi of the North. You can figure out exactly what it means to call the state Mississippi of the North. Hmm. Has a horrible history, but they got a lot of positive publicity after the primary because they sent out to all registered voters in the state an application for them to get an absentee ballot to be able to vote by mail. But the problem was, among other things, that you needed to get that application notarized or have an official documentation that you were who you were, in addition to you were already someone who was registered to vote, and add into that that you would then have to vote by mail, because voting by mail brings in an issue of political trust. I mentioned trust earlier in terms of low levels of trust in state and local governments. But when we did that survey, we also asked people how much trust they had that their vote would count. If they voted in person on election day, where you stick the ballot in the box and it mixes with all the other ballots, or you pull the lever, or you vote by mail. And what we found was low levels of trust in all forms of voting that were off the reservation, non-tribal. But the level of trust when we moved to voting by mail, at, for example, in Nevada, it was only 28% of the respondents said they trusted it. And South Dakota, it was even lower, 24%. Now, why is that? That is because when you vote by mail, your ballot goes in to a local election official. That person determines whether your ballot counts. They will look, they will have your name on the outside, they will know what precinct you are from, and it opens up the possibility of making racially discriminatory actions, possibly throwing ballots out that should not be thrown out.
But all right, and people know that. Yeah,
but even if it doesn't happen, there's that fear that it wouldn't happen.
Right. Well, finally, let me ask you this very briefly. Given the widespread enthusiasm in the electorate to vote this year in 2020, are you seeing that level of enthusiasm in Indian country as well?
Absolutely. I mean, there is no comparison with 2016. 2016, when I traveled around, I never saw signs. People would say, I don't see a difference. This year, there is incredible desire to vote. This last week in Minnesota, there was a voter registration drive on reservations, and over 8,000 people newly registered to vote. So yeah, there is a deep, deep desire and a sense that this is possibly the most important election in many, many people's lives. And certainly I think it is in mine.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Jean, for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you.
My guest has been Jean Reith Schrodel. She is the Thornton F. Bradshaw Professor of Public Policy at Claremont Graduate University. Her earlier book was Evangelicals and Democracy in America, Religion and Politics. We've been discussing her latest book called Voting in Indian Country, The View from the Trenches. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.